Are your ulcerative colitis symptoms proving difficult to manage? Tremfya guselkumab can help you manage the cycle of UC symptoms. At 1 year, many patients taking Tremfya achieved clinical remission, and some patients also achieved endoscopic remission. Individual results may vary. Tremfya is a prescription medicine used to treat adults with moderately to severely active ulcerative colitis. Serious allergic reactions and increased risk of infections may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and TB. Tell your doctor if you have an infection, flu-like symptoms, or if you need a vaccine. Ask your doctor if Tremfya can help you manage the cycle of UC symptoms. Call 1-800-526-7736 to learn more or visit TremfyaRadio.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Upgrade your business with Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. Shop Pay boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning fewer carts going abandoned and more sales going cha-ching. So if you're into growing your business, get a commerce platform that's ready to sell wherever your customers are. Visit Shopify.com to upgrade your selling today.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hope you had a great weekend. We're back in action now. So glad you're here. This hour, Kerry Erbon will be with us, Fox News legal analyst, and we need her to make sense of what's happening with this Mahmoud Khalil, this Columbia student now in an ICE holding center, hopefully to be deported. Legally, can we do it? I hope so. A lot more to follow. And we're going to be joined by Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins. I want to find out about all the tariffs and how it's affecting them, what they need from other countries from here on in. And we'll, of course, take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Good news is those astronauts that were trapped in space for 9 months because Boeing couldn't get them down, SpaceX is going to bring them down. Could be down tonight or tomorrow night. That should be great. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This problem isn't with the base and the core of the Democrat Party. They are as far underwater with young voters as I've seen. And I work for Obama. I've not seen Democrats this far underwater. A lot of this is really around the core and these young voters.
They don't like the young voters, no longer like the Democratic Party. And who can blame them? Dems in meltdown. Impossible to chronicle all the infighting on the left as their brawl over spending, tone, and tenor. And a way forward, as their numbers show, 27% approve of them. That's it.
Number two. This law is only ever invoked during actual wartime, last used during World War II. The judge in the case ordered the flights to return to the U.S., even if they were midair. But a defiant White House claims federal courts do not have jurisdiction to weigh in since the planes had already left U.S. territory.
Of course not. You can't stop terrorists being jettisoned out of our country to a El Salvador prison in mid-flight because you don't like Trump. I love it. The president sends MS-13 and Venezuelan prisoners, gang DDA, to El Salvador when in midair a judge rules that we have to bring these criminals back to America. Trump ignores it. Meanwhile, the border crackdown continues as we start building the wall left undone 4 years ago.
Number one.
This strike in Yemen is about their ability, the ability of the Houthis to strike global shipping and attack the U.S. Navy. There's no way the Houthis, okay, the Houthis would have the ability to do this kind of thing unless they had support from Iran.
And they got great intelligence from China and Russia. Trump hits the Houthis. They drove a drone attack back, and Iran gets a warning while the IDF seems poised to finish off Hamas, and they bombed Hezbollah about an hour ago over in the north. The Middle East is on fire this morning, but these are all problems that were festering that Trump has to address while giving all of them a door open for peace. Whether it's Hamas or whether it's the Houthi rebels or whether it's Iran. But I don't think any one of these issues will be solved by talking. That's not the way this region operates. We could go to school on this all day. Biden thought he'd try to keep a lid on it, told the Houthi rebels, "You're no longer on my list of terrorists. I blame Saudi Arabia. They're the tyrant nation." Man, did that blow up in their face and our face. They have shut down shipping in the region, costing us billions of dollars. We just stopped talking about it. But if you talk to people serving in the Navy, they're sitting there knocking down drone attacks $100 drones being knocked down by $1 million rockets. It wasn't working out for us. When we'd run out of rockets, we got to kind of leave. Meanwhile, it wasn't safe. We couldn't insure merchant ships to go through there. Here's Marco Rubio about the attack over the, excuse me, here's Pete Hegseth about the attack over the weekend, where we did not only took out structures, we took out terrorists. Cut three.
We're sitting on 4 years of deferred maintenance from Joe Biden, where in particular, when you talk about the Houthis, they were allowed for over 100 times to shoot at U.S. Ships, to shoot at commercial shipping. 4 months ago, when we sent a ship through, it was shot at 17 times. Ships haven't been able to go through for over a year without being shot at. Freedom of navigation is basic. It's a core national interest. And President Trump has said, we will restore that and we will be unrelenting.
And they did, and they're killing people, and they got to kill people. But they're getting intelligence from China and Russia, who give the coordinates of the locations of the ships coming through, and they have spy ships watching, calling out basically the numbers of these aircraft carriers or the merchant ships, coming cargo ships coming through. And why are we allowing Iran to do that? They're literally sitting in the canal, Suez Canal, calling this out. We've let this go for 2 years. When you talk about money and waste, that's what gets Trump's attention. Trump wrote that the relentless assaults have cost the U.S. and the world economy billions of dollars. It's been over a year since a U.S. flagged commercial ship got through safely through the Suez Canal, through the Red Sea, through the Gulf of Aden. So we're going around South Africa. That's not going to work for us. Why are we taking this? As Tom Cotton said over the weekend, we're letting goat herders keep us from commerce, letting them keep us from doing what we're supposed to be doing. Just let, for the record, 5 years ago, 60 Minutes special, how Saudi Arabia is indiscriminately bombing Yemen, how many innocent people are being hurt, when in reality, this terrorist group were beginning to feel themselves and find out what the parameters are before they get hit back. And when the world turned on Saudi Arabia, the Houthis got off the terror list. Then they got armed to the teeth by Iran, Syria, Russia, and China, and now they're a real problem. Here's Mike Waltz, Cuff 5.
These were not kind of pinprick, back and forth, what ultimately proved to be feckless attacks. This was an overwhelming response that actually targeted multiple Houthi leaders and took them out. And the difference here is, one, going after the Houthi leadership, and two, holding Iran responsible.
It looks like we killed at least 31 people over the weekend. Now, they answered last night, I don't know the time difference, hours ago, and we knocked all the drones out of the sky, but that's not the point. They're trying to say you didn't kill us. We killed a lot of them, but we're going to go and finish them. Israel's doing the same thing. They're sending intercontinental missiles right into the heart of Tel Aviv. Please. Here's Scott Bessent, Cut 9.
It's a very strong message and very different than the previous administration. So the Houthis, the Iranians, should expect that this is the beginning. This is not a one-off. And we are doing this because they are blocking freedom of passage for global shipping. And, Chris, back to the economy, back to inflation, that closing the Suez Canal slows global commerce and increases inflationary pressure for both us and our allies. So we are sending a message. This is unacceptable.
And we've got to find out, and our Treasury Department can do this, who's financing these people. Because they're not even controlling Yemen. They're controlling a portion of Yemen. Quick note, how does this relate to Iran? Well, the president sent, and I told you about the back door to open up the show. The president is not saying, I'm going to finish you. I'm giving you a chance at peace. So they wrote a letter, strong letter. We could try to walk back and eliminate your nuclear program, or we could do it a different way. They took that as a threat. And again, after we hit the Houthi rebels, armed by Iran predominantly, the president also sent a message to Iran, who said this: if threatened, Iran will give appropriate and crushing responses. That according to their Major General Hussein Salami, commander of the IRGC. Iran's foreign minister said the United States government has no authority or business dictating Iranian foreign policy. That era ended in 1979. We will see. Because there's a 40-year opening right now, thanks to Israel. And now they're fully armed with 2,000-pound bombs. I think you should count the moments where you still have the remnants of a nuclear program. I think the American people would fully understand if Trump took it out, because he's first giving them an option to avoid all this, but it can't be avoided. And I don't think Israel is going to wait much longer, even if Joe Biden was still president, which is a scary thought. So I want to get to the Venezuelan situation. We will be able to send people back to Venezuela, but the TDA is such a vicious prison gang. They were let out for a reason. Venezuela's already showed they can't keep them out. So we wanted to send them to El Salvador, who volunteered for a price to hold them in solitary confinement for at least a year and lock them up forever. So they took them. Both El Salvador and the U.S. were mocking this Texas judge, this D.C. judge, for thinking they could stop these flights. And now there's going to be people rallying. Now, Democrats will rally for this. Now, think about this. You're trying to get Khalil free, okay, a Syrian-born Palestinian sympathizer with hooks to Hamas who have caused unrest, ungrateful unrest in Colombia. That's who you want to rally for? And now you want to rally for the rights of TDA gangsters? You can have it. Good luck, guys. Good luck, Ms. Crockett. Good luck with this, Senator Murphy. You continue to call President Trump an outlaw regime while he's trying to get rid of criminals who violate our law, all committed crimes once in this country. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We'll go to the legalities of all this in just a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Even if you think it's a bit overhyped, AI is suddenly everywhere, from self-driving cars to molecular medicine to business efficiency. And if it's not in your industry yet, it's coming fast. But AI needs a lot of speed and computing power, so how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? Time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. Or OCI. OCI is a blazing fast and secure platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, plus all of your AI and machine learning workloads. OCI costs 50% less for compute and 80% less for networking. So you're saving a pile of money. Thousands of businesses have already upgraded to OCI, including Vodafone, Thomson Reuters, and Suno AI. Right now, Oracle is offering to cut your current bill, your current cloud bill, in half if you move to OCI. For new U.S. customers with minimal financial commitment, and the offer ends March 31st. See if your company qualifies for this special offer at oracle.com/Cain. That's oracle.com/CAIN.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'll simply say they never should have been allowed into our country in the first place. It's our responsibility to protect our families, to keep our streets clean and safe. And that's exactly what the president said he was going to do. And that's what you're seeing being executed right now. We will follow the law. The law is clear. We believe that we can do this. Let's get these folks off the streets. Let's get them out of our country. They never should have been allowed here in the first place.
Absolutely. And that is Senator Mike Rounds, hardly a firebrand of South Dakota, talking about the hundreds of illegal alien criminals who were sent out of our country to El Salvador. There are some MS-13, no doubt about it. Most were TDA, all victims who all committed crimes here while being here illegally, coming to the country in different ways. You had 261 illegal aliens deported. 137 were from the Alien Enemies Act, 101 were from Venezuela, 21 from MS-13, two special cases of MS-13. They were actually ringleaders. So, Kerry Urban, great to have you back, Fox News legal editor. Your thoughts about what this judge did trying to turn around that flight heading into El Salvador?
Well, I think the wrong question in general is being asked, and which is, what authority does President Trump have to do this thing? Which is a fine question, but the bigger question, Brian, in my opinion, is what authority does the judge have to interfere in the executive branch executing this kind of action? No one's asking that question. People are just accepting left and right the fact that these judges are stepping in and unilaterally really usurping the democratic process and stopping President Trump, from exercising his authority in this area. Now, here we know that he invoked an act that was first established in 1798, and it's typically a wartime act. But the key provision in that act is whether I'm going to read it directly. He says, I find and declare that the TDA, Trinidad Aragua, is perpetuating, attempting, and threatening an invasion or predatory incursion against the territory of the United States, undertaking hostile actions and conducting irregular warfare against the territory of the U.S., both directly and at the direction, clandestine or otherwise, of the Maduro regime in Venezuela. That is, he's quoting direct language from this Aliens and Sedition Act. And that's why we are in the situation that we are. But as we know, a judge ordered this plane to be turned around. They didn't turn the plane around. They say it was too late. And really, the question is, does the judge even have the authority at all to order a plane in a situation like this to be turned around?
So this is what this judge, Boasberg, said. Any plane containing those folks that is going to take off or is in the air needs to be returned to the United States. However that is accomplished, make sure it's complied with immediately. He went on. I do not believe I can wait any longer and I'm required to act. A brief delay in their removal does not cause the government any harm. The ACLU rang in. Arthur Spitzer says there is no foreign military action to justify President Trump's intended invocation of this act, making these actions not only unlawful, but an outright assault on fundamental rights. We really love these rights of illegal alien criminals.
Yeah, of foreign gangs, right? I mean, Trinidad Aragua, when I was at the Department of Justice, which was between 2018 and 2020, Trinidad Aragua wasn't even a thing. It was MS-13. It became a real problem in this country with Joe Biden's open border policies. And if you look at the data, you see that people from Venezuela, including a lot of people from this gang, started pouring over our borders. I believe it was around 21 and 22. And we have, obviously, lots of stories, Brian, some of which you mentioned at the top of this interview, of them engaging in all kinds of violent acts against America. What's interesting, and this hasn't, I don't think, gotten any attention yet, but I found a filing that was submitted to this judge over the weekend, and it's from a top official at the State Department, and he's a career guy, okay? So he's not a political appointee. He's been there since 1971, and he expresses concern over someone stopping, like this judge is, from Trump deporting these Venezuelans. In fact, he, in this filing, which, you know, you have to say it's an affidavit, so there are serious consequences if you're not being truthful or forthcoming, he discusses the fact that Secretary Marco Rubio, Rick Grenell, the special envoy for Latin America, have negotiated at the highest levels with the government of El Salvador and with Nicolas Maduro himself and his representatives in Venezuela in recent weeks for those countries to consent to the removal to Venezuela and El Salvador of some of these Venezuelan nationals. Mm-hmm. But listen to this, Brian. This is why this is, I think, very important. He says this, the foreign policy of the United States would suffer harm if the removal of individuals associated with TDA were prevented. And here's why. Because of the amount of energy and time that the U.S. government has taken with other countries, he says that these other countries won't take us seriously in the future if this is prevented unilaterally by judges and could seriously impact foreign policy on a lot of levels.
So, and who wrote that?
That's a career official from the State Department who's been there since 1971.
Okay.
So, which I think is pretty interesting. So he submitted that as part of the filing. So the ACLU submitted their complaint over the weekend. This guy submitted this. And then there's an expedited appeal on this before the D.C. Court of Appeals, the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C. And briefing is due from both sides tomorrow and Wednesday. So we'll see what happens.
Right. But, Carrie, now this fight is gone. They're in jail. What about the next one? Is the next one going to be stopped from flying?
Right. Well, that's why this is so important. And I actually think it's a great fight for the Trump administration to have because, you know, I hate to say it, Brian, but when, you know, watching these judges step in unilaterally over and over and over again, you have to start wondering, what's the point of having presidential elections if the judicial branch is just going to stop a president every time he takes action anywhere? And when you think about the amount of nationwide injunctions that have been issued against the Trump administration, in the 20th century, 100 years I'm talking about right now, 27 nationwide injunctions were issued over that 100-year period against various administrations. In Trump term one, 55 in total, 37 in the first 2 years alone.
Unbelievable.
I mean, if that doesn't tell you everything you need to know, I don't know what does.
Right. So we'll see what happens. They want to impeach this judge. It's an Obama judge. I'm not sure that's going to go anywhere. And what do you do?
Right.
Just keep on rifling up the system until you get to the Supreme Court on everything?
I have a couple thoughts on this. One, I'm sure the lawyers within the Trump administration are asking themselves, you know, how many times can we go to the Supreme Court, right? Because the Supreme Court cares, too, about how many times they get involved. But I'm hoping that this is such an overstepping of a judge that it spurs the Supreme Court into action.
I hope so, too. Carrie, you're the best. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. You're all over all these cases. Amazing to me. Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, next. Don't move.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The farmers never did better than when I was president. Now, this is a very different thing for the farmers. Here, the farmers are going to make their money at home because they're not going to be able to dump all this stuff from, in many cases, dirty stuff, but they're not going to dump it into our country. The farmers can make it and sell it locally as opposed to going and selling it overseas to China. It's very different. But there ultimately be more money for the farmer.
So that is President Trump talking about the farmers and how they're going to deal with the tariffs and the looming trade wars. It's going to break out when we break into reciprocal trade with everybody on the planet, including Europe. Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins, the 33rd U.S. Secretary, joins us now. Congratulations, Ms. Secretary, on getting the role. And now you're in the middle of some stressful times. What is the biggest risk for farmers with this tariff roll, with these tariffs?
Well, first of all, good morning, Brian. Great to be with you. I think there's no doubt that our farmers are concerned, but I'll also say there's no doubt that they believe in President Trump's vision and in his leadership. And no group has been more with the president from the beginning. I think 90% in the last election is the vote total for President Trump over Kamala Harris. And at the end of the day, they realize that there may be some bumpy times ahead, but again, believe in his vision. We're doing everything we can to expand markets across the country, but while also ensuring, to his point, that we're selling as much as we can internally. And that's the realignment that's going on. That's his vision, and that's, I think, what the people voted for last November.
How would you characterize our agriculture relationship with Canada?
Well, you know, I don't mean to make light of it, but how wonderful when President Trump, in very colorful language, told the former prime minister, whom he called Governor Trudeau, that what the tariffs were doing to our dairy, for example, 250% tariff on our dairy products from Canada, that's just not okay. And we've let it go for too long, and people have looked the other direction, and our farmers deserve better. So listen, I had a great conversation with Trudeau's Canadian Secretary of Agriculture just a week ago. I think it was just a couple of days before the new prime minister there announced the new Secretary of Ag, so I have not connected with him yet. But we had a really good conversation. I did the same with the Secretary of Agriculture from Mexico that clearly, you know, I am here to effectuate President Trump's vision. But at the end of the day, we all just want what's best for our country. And they understood, and for our farmers and our jobs. And they understood that. And so I look forward to, you know, again, fighting for what President Trump is looking to achieve, but doing it through every diplomatic avenue that's possible to protect and preserve our ag community in America.
So they say in 2018, when you got into the China, not you, but the previous Trump administration got into the tariff war with China, they lost $27 billion. And soybean made up virtually 71% of annual losses. The trade war now has lasting damage, they say. The U.S. has yet to fully recover its losses in its market share of soybean exports to China, mainly because the pandemic hit and then you have a new administration follow through. How can you change that? And how could you voice that to the administration?
I think that's a really good point. And but here's one point, Brian, that you or your listeners may not realize. When President Trump, when we left the first time I was his domestic policy chief in the White House, so I was next to him and obviously worked on a larger portfolio than just agriculture. But when we left, there was a $0 trade deficit for our ag products, for our farmers and our ranchers in America. This was in 2020, zero. In 4 years, Joe Biden somehow, I don't know how you do this other than through just pure negligence, we have a $49 billion trade deficit in 4 years, just in agriculture. So you think about the loss of markets, you think about the loss of opportunity, you think about the, you know, unbelievable lack of hustle to get our products out into the world. And I've already had multiples of conversations. We'll be making my first international trip shortly. And this is even outside of the trade reps and the people in the administration who work on trade all day, every day. What I'm trying to do is just go across the world and open up new markets. So I believe very strongly that we are going to have incredible success doing that. And I think that, you know, that what you just talked about in the soybeans in China, I think we're going to be able to really make up for most of that, if not all of it, and perhaps even more when we've got new and emerging markets like India, like Thailand and others, where we can begin to move our products out regardless of a trade war with China.
So right now we know that India has a lot of tariffs on our things, and it's going to be addressed, I guess, in the first week in April. And we'll see if it ends up being a negotiation rather than a war. They say right now, they did a study, they say, what are the farmers most concerned about? And they say the number one is trade. Number two is crop insurance. Number three is interest, because they got to take out loans in order to do their thing every year. The environment, 7%, and energy, 9%. So trade's the number one concern. So what do you see your responsibility? What does your voice mean in the White House during tariff talk?
My approach on this, Brian, is perhaps a little bit different than my predecessors in that I am working to every day ensure that the president, the White House, our trade negotiators understand at the front end what some of the implications are for our farmers and our ranchers and our ag community. And listen, the community is hurting. We are, you know, in profit. Profits are way, way down. We've lost a lot of family farms over the last decade, perhaps have more. The interest rates are high. To your point, the access to capital is not what it once was. The opportunity to get into farming is almost zero at this point, unless you're a multi-generational family farm. We've got a lot of major issues we're working to address. On the trade side, working with the White House to make sure we understand at the front end what's happening, right, and how to potentially mitigate some of that, but then also having the programs at the back end, which is what the last Trump administration did when that $27 billion hit came from the trade war with China and others. There was some market facilitation program funds that went out to our farmers to make sure that they were made whole from that. And we'll do that hopefully again. We're building the programs out now.
Why is it harder to get money, financing for farms, being that it's such a necessity?
You know, there's a lot of reasons for that. The market has changed so drastically. There's so much unpredictability. When you've got, you know, years and years and years of government intervention, which in many cases is justified, especially if you want a strong ag community. But anytime the government's involved, it absolutely messes up the markets. The banks are not as willing to loan today as they once were because the profit margins are so thin, because we've lost so many farms. So this is a major bucket of issues that we're going to be working to fix in the coming weeks and months and years. You'll be hearing a lot of forward-leaning offensive play from our office over at USDA on how we fix it. A big part of that's deregulation. The amount of regulations that the Biden administration put on these farmers in the last 4 years is astounding. The cost of input, including energy, which you mentioned, has gone up 30% under Joe Biden. You combine that with a $49 billion trade deficit, right? Costs went up to do business. The market shrunk. Well, there's no wonder that the banks don't want to loan the money for these farmers moving forward until they see some predictability on what it is that you're going to be doing to fix it.
We're talking to Brooke Rollins, the Secretary of Agriculture, as we look at the April 2nd reciprocal day in which all the tariffs become reciprocal. Whatever you're charging us, we're charging you, and vice versa. So what country should we focus on the most? If I want to make the farmers the happiest, what country will we be best off balancing out our trade relationship?
Well, here's the good news. I don't want to say one country. We're in discussions with many, and I don't want to compromise those discussions. But I will say this. I see the opportunity as just boundless. I see the opportunity in every country we're talking to and every trip we're planning to make. And again, across the Trump government, you know, we're all hustlers at the end of the day. We're all working to put America first. But in order to do that, we've got to get out into the world and make our case. And we're not, you know, it's been, 50 days, 52 days. And I think the American people see that we are bold, we are tireless, we are relentless in everything we're doing across the government, whether it's shrinking government, reduction in force, moving out our energy, independence, you know, peace through strength with Pete Hegseth, the border. But it's the same in the trade world, too. And the team that the president has assembled is, I believe, unprecedented. And I think we're going to see some incredible wins for the American people, in my world, for the American farmer.
So I want you to hear what Bhatia Unger Sargon, a big guest on our show, is on with Bill Maher over the weekend. And they're trying to make some sense of the tariffs and the reciprocal tariffs and the back and forth tariff fights that we're witnessing. Cut 30.
He does not believe in free trade. He looked at our destroyed manufacturing base. He looked at the downwardly mobile working class. He looked at the fact that working class Americans can no longer afford the American dream. And he looked at why that was, which was there was a handshake agreement between both parties that we should somehow have free trade, which resulted in shipping 5 million good manufacturing jobs overseas to build up China and Mexico.
And some came here.
No, what they did was they brought in millions and millions of illegal migrants to compete with the jobs that remained here. And what Donald Trump said was, we have to stop selling out the working class. That agenda that he laid out, socially moderate, anti-war, and anti-free trade protectionist, that is a leftist agenda.
Sam, I will bring you in.
Is she right?
I think she's right. I mean, there are a couple of nuances in there that I may argue a little bit differently, but she's 1,000% right that what we've seen, well, first of all, when President Trump, the first time in 2016, her point is really, really true, that the hollowing out of our manufacturing towns and cities across the country was real, and we had shipped so many jobs overseas. And in that first term, we saw the comeback. I mean, it was remarkable. Even when I went to Washington from Texas, Brian, I didn't know that we would be able to make that much of a difference. Most people thought Washington was lost. But in those 4 years, well, really 3 years until COVID hit, what we proved was less government, lower taxes, more freedom, less regulation. You can power the great American comeback. And we ended with lower poverty rates, higher job rates than on record for almost every single category of worker in this country. Then, of course, it was interrupted in 2020 with what we believe was a taken election. Mm-hmm. And we saw, again, the downward slide, perhaps at even warp speed, under Joe Biden and the Democrats as they worked to move the whole government towards DEI and transgender and more government and higher spending. And then we saw it slip back again. But now, you know, these numbers, even in just 50 days, show that these policies matter. And what she was outlining, you know, over the weekend is 1,000% right, that we've got to get back to putting Americans first. We've got to secure the border. We've got to bring manufacturing back onshore. And when you do that, you take the American dream into every corner of our country and perhaps even into places that haven't ever seen it before.
Have you been talking and interacting with HHS, being that we're so focused now on cleaning out our food, finding out what we're eating, also the chemicals and pesticides that might be necessary? Has there been any intermingling of the two philosophies on the new Trump team?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, when Bobby Kennedy walked out onto that stage in August in Phoenix of 2020, and I thought to my, and of course had no idea I was going to end up in the cabinet or be the Secretary of Agriculture, but I thought to myself that this is what our country needs, that when you look at the chronic diseases and the obesity epidemic, when you look at especially how it's hitting those in the lower socioeconomic levels across our country, that it's just it's a travesty, that we've got to make some significant changes. I'd never met Bobby Kennedy before, but that very day I was running the America First Policy Institute. That very day I reached out to him and said, I want to help build this out in a way that, you know, we can make real change for our country. The fact that we both ended up in the cabinet may be somewhat providential, but I work very closely with Bobby. We don't agree on everything, and we have agreed to disagree on some things, but for the most part, we are aligned.
In terms of pesticides and hard, you know, the corn syrup and things of that nature. Lastly, egg prices are going down slightly. With the bird flu, is this handled now? Now can you just get back to competing and producing?
Well, they haven't just gone down slightly. Actually, I think as of this morning, 44%
Excellent.
Since President Trump took office. But the avian bird flu does not go away overnight. The Biden team had 2 years to come up with some real solutions and didn't do anything. So, you know, I've been hedging and warning everyone that while the prices have come down, I think the market reacted in a really positive way to our 5-point plan we laid out about 3 or 4 weeks ago. But we've got a long way to go, Brian, and it's going to take a lot of work to hopefully get this avian bird flu under control. But the good news is today, and hopefully for the longer term, the prices of eggs have come down.
All right. Thanks so much. Best of luck. Secretary of Agriculture
Brooke
Rollins will be talking to you a lot with all this trade and find out how the farmers, the hardest working people in the country are doing. Thanks, Brooke.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Back in a moment.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm William Googe, a Vuori collaborator and professional ultrarunner from the UK. I love to tackle endurance runs around the world, including a 55-day, 3,064-mile run across the US. So I know a thing or two about performance wear. When it comes to relaxing, I look for something ultra-versatile and comfy. The Ponto Performance Jogger from Vuori is perfect for all of those things. It's the comfiest jogger I've ever worn. And the DreamKnit fabric is why I'll always reach for them over other joggers. Check them out in the DreamKnit collection by going to vuori.com/William. That's vuori.com/William, where new customers can receive 20% off their first order. Plus, enjoy free shipping in the US on orders over $75 and free returns. Exclusions apply. Visit the website for full terms and conditions.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I think there can be sincere Republicans.
But you can't be a sincere black Republican.
I don't think that you can be a rational MAGA, be black and be a rational MAGA person. I think you can be black and be a Republican.
I think they would find that very insulting.
Well, I mean, the truth is often insulting.
Really? That's why Don Lemon doesn't have a job. Why people are so interested in what this guy has to say, I don't know. But he was on, keep in mind, he was getting a 1-0 in the number one spot in a network that's carried on every cable system in every airport. That's under 1 million people at 8 o'clock at night. Then they put him in the morning, and he was so repulsive, they fired him. Fired him. And as a black guy getting fired on CNN, it makes it tough. But he, again, is making it clear that he's unemployable. Another thing, Don Lemon got an offer. He said, I'm going to hire Tucker Carlson, did Elon Musk, and I'm going to show you how diverse I want X. I'm going to hire Don Lemon. He said, yeah, fine, if I could interview you first. And Elon Musk said, yeah. And then he was so rude and abrasive and condescending. Elon Musk says, I'm not hiring you. And now he's nowhere. And he gets guests on all these shows. He's on Page Six, unemployable. Nobody cares what he thinks. And that statement is so ridiculous. If you look at how more and more black people and Hispanics are voting for Republican and looking honestly at the candidate and not looking at the color of their skin or the party that they represent, it's incredible. Especially if you're Jewish. If you're Jewish, how can you possibly vote for a Democrat? I mean, think about this. You have the leading Democrat in the country, Chuck Schumer, not even speaking out for 2 years, doing much more than anything more than lip service about what's happening with the anti-Semitism raging on elite campuses across our country, only condemning what he thinks is Netanyahu's tough attacks in Gaza. Michael Rappaport weighed in, too, on Democrats. Cut 23.
You guys know I voted for cadaver Joe Biden, smoking Joe Biden. Okay. Voted for Hillary Clinton. Okay. This is why the Democrats are in the dump, because you celebrate people like Khalil Muhammad, Muhammad Khalil. You celebrate people like Luigi Mangione. You go out on the streets, you go f-ing crazy for the wrong people. These outlier freaks. You go nuts for the wrong people.
And he gets angrier from there. Now they're rallying around, I guess, TDA today. The prison gang killing Lake and Riley, killing the killing Nunnery. Forgot her first name. Feel bad about that. Who just died, their family. These are all TDA members. We see them in New York all the time. Joe Biden didn't even want a roster of people who were staying on our dime for free in New York City. Trump is making everybody log in and then get out. And then you wonder why people are voting like Joe Rogan and other people saying, I'm not a Democrat anymore.
What makes a great pair of glasses? At Warby Parker, it's all the invisible extras without the extra cost. Their designer quality frames start at $95, including prescription lenses, plus scratch-resistant, smudge-resistant, and anti-reflective coatings, and UV protection, and free adjustments for life. To find your next pair of glasses, sunglasses, or contact lenses, or to find the Warby Parker store nearest you, head over to warbyparker.com. That's warbyparker.com.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi everyone. Hope you had a great weekend. We're back in action now, right in New York City, where it's rainy but nice, and they're about to put together the longest running parade in American history, dating back to 1762. It must be St. Patrick's Day. And yes, I forgot my green tie, but Lawrence Jones was able to step up. And by the time I get to the five tonight, no one will remember that I forgot. Senator Rick Scott's going to be on with me today in 34 minutes. Michael Goodwin standing by. And of course, there's a lot of breaking news, including the Houthi rebels hitting back at us or trying to hit back at our ships right in the Strait, the Strait of Hormuz today. And we're also looking at the Gulf of Aden and all those areas we're looking to open up. So before I get to Michael, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This problem isn't with the base and the core of the Democrat Party. They are as far underwater with young voters as I've seen. And I work for Obama. I've not seen Democrats this far underwater. A lot of this is really around the core and these young voters.
That's a Democratic pollster, Cornell Belcher on Meet the Press. The Dems are in meltdown. Impossible to chronicle all the infighting on the left as they brawl over a spending bill. They brawl over tenure and the tone of a party and a way forward while they're in the minority.
Number two.
This law is only ever invoked during actual wartime, last used during World War II. The judge in the case ordered the flights to return to the U.S., even if they were midair. But a defiant White House claims federal courts do not have jurisdiction to weigh in since the planes had already left U.S. territory.
Yes, and therefore they get to go to El Salvador. I love it. The president sends MS-13 and the Venezuelan prison gang TDA to El Salvador when an order in midair goes handed down by a judge who said, turn the planes around. Trump says, no way. Meanwhile, the border crackdown continues as we start building the wall left undone 4 years ago.
Number one.
This strike in Yemen is about their ability, the ability of the Houthis to strike global shipping and attack the U.S. Navy. There's no way the Houthis, okay, the Houthis would have the ability to do this kind of thing unless they had support from Iran.
So true. Trump hits the Houthis. They draw their drone attack back, and Iran gets a warning while the IDF seems poised to finish off Hamas and hit Hezbollah a few hours ago. The Middle East is on fire this morning with all the problems coming to a head, and Donald Trump is plowing the ground, I think, to hit all of them right away. Michael Goodwin, I saw your column, and I want to talk about local domestic politics, but first things first. We hit the Houthis Saturday. But this time, we didn't just hit rocket launchers. We hit them. We killed at least 39. And then we gave them a warning. The worst is yet to come. And we also realized we were on the receiving end of a bunch of drones a few hours ago. Where do you think this is heading? Because it was accompanied by a warning to Iran.
Good morning, Brian. Look, I think it is further proof of Iran's mendacity and the fact that it has armed these groups or financed the arming of them. I mean, they are they are a veritable army on their own. They're a terrorist group too, but they do have significant armaments, and they've shown that before, attacking our ships with missiles, firing into Israel, which is a very long distance adventure for them. So that they are well armed. Hamas was, Hezbollah. These are the Iranian proxies throughout the area, and they've been waging this war on Israel. And every time we step in, then we get directly attacked. And I think that it really does speak to Iran's overall objective, which is to get America out of the Mideast so that it can then destroy Israel or fight it out with Israel anyway without American involvement. And they want to dominate the region. They want to eliminate Israel. Eliminating Israel is part of that plan. So I think that's what they're trying to do here. They're trying to make it such as we will pay a price. America will pay a price if it raises its finger in the Mideast. Therefore, we're going to chop off that finger.
But it's a lot different now. I think it's different now, Michael. You know why? Because most of the Gulf states are on our side. Most of the Gulf states are on Israel's side. And most of the Gulf states are so glad that we're there and Joe Biden isn't. And I think that there's one country stopping us from a period of somewhat civil rest instead of unrest, and it's Iran. And they got a warning. So the president gives you an off-ramp. Guys, we could do it one way, which is get rid of your nuclear program, or we could do it another way. And they are upset about the threats.
Yes, they are, but I think it's still about us being there. That's what they have long aspired to do, going back to the attack on the Marine barracks many years ago. It's getting America out of the Mideast so they can dominate the region. And when you think of it that way, when you look back, say, on the Obama policies, right, which was to coax Iran back in, it's all foolish. I mean, they are a kind of suicidal death cult that wants to subjugate everybody in the region. And the United States being there is important for our security. It's important for Israel's security, but it's important for global security too. Imagine Iran dominating all of the oil countries, all of the oil Arab countries. I mean, it would be a fearsome force, and that's why it's important that the United States not withdraw.
Absolutely. I want you to hear what Mike Waltz said, and this is the difference. When you're going to hit, you got to hit hard. Cut six.
It is Iran that has repeatedly funded, resourced, trained, and helped the Houthis target not only U.S. warships, but global commerce, and has helped the Houthis shut down two of the world's most strategic sea lanes. We have, Martha, 70% of global shipping is now diverting around southern Africa, adding to the cost of goods, disrupting global economies, adding to or shutting off supplies to the United States. President Trump has found it unacceptable.
See, people don't talk about it. We just, there's some rockets and the Houthis, we're knocking them down. No one talked about we just basically have given up trying to use these major thoroughfares, these major waterway passageways that we have to deliver goods in, because you can't insure a merchant ship to go through there.
That's right. And so the longer these ships are at sea, the more expensive it is, right? So for the cost to all the parties involved goes way up. As you say, even the insurance costs can't possibly cover it. So they've taken over that region, and we apparently were willing to accept that, but now the attacks have gone too far. And so I think this is a big moment. It's not just swatting at a fly here. This is a bigger problem, and it remains to be seen how long and how far the Donald Trump will go in solving this problem, or is it just another warning to the Houthis? They don't take advice well.
So, Michael Goodwin, you know New York well, but New York also has the power of politicians on the Democratic side, Hakeem Jeffries in the House, Senator Schumer in the Senate. And for the first time I can remember in 20 years, we have a united Republican Party putting all the pressure on Democrats, and they're coming apart at the seams. When Speaker Johnson delivered the House and delivered that the CR with some amendments in it to the Senate, when did the Democrats realize they had no power? They were done. They were finished. They were through. You talk about this being a masterclass for Trump. How?
Well, look, the shutdown issue is one that the Republicans always lose, right? The Democrats control the media, and so the media would always argue that shutting down the Republicans or want to shut down the government again, and the Democrats would always stay united. The Republicans would fracture. They'd fight with themselves, even when they held the majority, and so the Democrats always won these things. If there was a shutdown, the media would blame Republicans. If there was no shutdown, the Democrats got what they wanted in the continuing resolutions. This time, the script was flipped, and Donald Trump did that. Remember the pressure he put on the House, on the rebel members to agree to this? Only one did not, Massey from Kentucky. And then he held that unity and in the Senate. And remember when Schumer said, we're going to shut it down. We're never going to agree. The Republicans didn't flinch. And in the end, the Democrats fractured and they caved in to the bill. And look, I think this is the sort of thing that Donald Trump has changed. He's given the Republican Party a spine and given it sort of the wherewithal to fight back, to resist, not to be cowed by the media. That, to me, is the biggest thing, Brian. So this time you saw the media basically turning on the Democrats. Why did you cave in? Why did you do this? Why did you do that? That's what they usually do to Republicans. And so mm-hmm. I think this is a big victory. It's really just on a spending measure that's only for, 6 months or so. But it really does show a defiant Republican Party willing to push back against the media, willing to take the bluffs of Democrats. And this is something that only Donald Trump could do.
Yeah, I want you to hear what Hakeem Jeffries was asked about. And look at how they're divided. Just to give people an idea, Crockett against Fetterman, they're going for the jugular. Then you have Sinema, the former Democrat, going against AOC. They're going for the jugular. And Hakeem Jeffries was asked about Senator Schumer. Listen to this, cut 14.
I do expect to have a conversation with him at some point later on today. Look, Chuck and I disagreed as it relates to the approach and outcome relative to what we viewed as a reckless Republican spending bill and the effort to try to jam these cuts down the throats of the American people.
And when asked on Friday, does he still have your confidence? He said, next question. Does he not understand? If anybody understands when you have leverage or not, it should be somebody in leadership. For example, if Mitch McConnell was in that spot, he would have has to have caved because he doesn't want to shut down the government when there's no off ramp. How do you do that without eating crow and just firing it up again? Because Trump will just decide to fund any program he wants and defund any program he wants. And that is a Schumer nightmare.
That's right. And that's where Donald Trump is different from George Bush or anybody else in that job, that he's willing to take it on and do what has to be done to win the battle. It's not the war. It's just a battle. But it was a big one. And I think that was a good sign for Republicans that they can take these attacks and come out and prevail in the end. I mean, the media is the media. It's not going to change. But fundamentally, you have to be willing to take that risk. And Trump is. And I think that, look, think about it this way, Brian. Republicans have the White House, the Senate, and the House. Why are they playing defense?
Yeah.
I mean, Trump, that's basically the message that Trump
sent. Because you know what the Democrats thought, Michael?
Defense.
Michael Goodwin, they thought for sure the Republicans couldn't get out of the House, and they're going to have to cut a deal, and they'll get a sweet deal by the time it arrived in the Senate. When Speaker Johnson delivered it, Schumer's jaw was probably on the ground. And he's like, "What? I have no cards right now." Now, the next thing will be the spring when they have the big, beautiful bill. that they say can't get out of the House. Really? Are you still going to doubt it? Because they're about to get maybe two more seats from Florida because Waltz has never been filled. Stefanik has never been filled. And they have the other suit by there's another seat that needs to be filled. So they'll have maybe a 4 or 5 seat cushion. I would not doubt the House.
And a Democrat died, so there's an empty seat there too.
Yeah, that's right. So all of a sudden they're going to get ramrodded. My thing is, if I'm the Democrats, I just say to myself, what do I stand for? What do I believe? And do I want to die on the hill of Mahmoud Khalil? Do I want to go to bat for TDA and turn that plane around before it lands in El Salvador with the prison gangsters? Do I want to land on the 20% of the American people who think it's a good idea for men to play in women's sports? They just got to go. They have to go see a therapist.
Yeah, look, I think you put it well, Brian, that where do they turn? What do they stand for? What hill are they ready to die on? I mean, that's what you need. You need some great conviction that your party stands behind. And so far, it's just, well, we hate Donald Trump and everything he stands for. But that only works at election time. That doesn't work when you're making the sausage. I mean, you've got to have something else. And that's the stage we're in now. The election is over. Trump has a free hand, and he's showing how to use the power. I mean, it is quite a display. And whether you like him or not, this is something to behold, because we haven't seen this in a long time.
How about this? We have issues. We're not doing them one at a time. He hires the people. He gets them confirmed. He goes, go to work. Go to work on Russia, Ukraine. Go to work on Hamas. Go to work on what's happening with Venezuela and our prisoners. Go to work on Central and South America. Get rid of these criminals that beat our border 8 million strong. Start cleaning out the sanctuary cities. And everyone's going to work. And no Democrat can keep up with the pace in which he's doing it. Now, not everything is going great. I have no idea if Russia's going to come aboard. I don't know when the hostage talks are going to fall apart. I'm not sure if the Houthi rebels are ever going to get the message. But all these are problems that he was elected to fix, so at least he's addressing them. Final thought.
Well, yes, and I think for a president to do all that, he needs to be a president in full. By that, I mean the way Trump got his nominees through the Senate, right? There were all kinds of predictions that a lot of them wouldn't make it. Well, Matt Gaetz was really the only one that fell out, right? And I think that's a good thing. But so I think that the president kind of stepping up, taking the brickbats, he will stand there alone. Just that image of him with the assassination attempt, getting up and saying, fight, fight, fight. That I think, animates the entire party still. And he's showing that. Mm-hmm. He's still doing that. And as you say, there are mistakes. There will be failures. Things will go wrong. Nonetheless, you can't get anything done unless you have that first desire to win and willingness to take chances. And I think that's what he's doing.
Mike Goodwin, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
Take your risk. You get elected to solve problems. You got to be willing to fail. And then you just adjust course and go back at it again. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
One party, Republicans, is about action, and the other party, Democrats, is not. So what reason do I have to continue to support the party of inaction? They will always and forever continue to have a messaging problem because Democrats have a leadership problem. And it's time for the Chuck Schumers of the world, the Hakeem Jeffries of the world, to step down, go away. We need people in those positions willing to fight. Not only should Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries step down, any Democrat who isn't fighting for the people and standing with the party should be primaried. Okay, we the people have zero confidence in Democratic leadership.
See, the thing is, I don't get the word fight. Just tell me what the issue is. It's not a fisticuff situation. So look at what Trump is doing. Pick out the areas in which you don't like Doge is doing. Pick up the areas in foreign policy you don't like he's doing there. Pick out the ones you do like. There's some things he does. He's doing a lot of the things that Obama pledged to do. Pick out the other things that, on the spending bill. Well, what didn't you like about the spend, the CR? 2/3 of it was what Joe Biden put forward. So just to go, oh, we win, we lose, we got to keep fighting. Well, you got to know when to fight, too. You had zero leverage. Stand for something. That would be key.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I want to be very clear. This campaign is about freedom of navigation and restoring deterrence. The minute the Houthis say, we'll stop shooting at your ships, we'll stop shooting at your drones, this campaign will end. And the president understands that. Global shipping, global commerce, when it's threatened by effectively pirates and piracy, and you have to divert and go an extra 2 weeks costing millions and then eventually billions of dollars.
And that's Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defense, talking about why we hit the Houthi rebels, killed 39 and hopefully destroyed more than just rocket launchers over the weekend. Why? I did not know this. 176 attacks over the last 3 years. What did Joe Biden do? Well, first, he took them off the terror watch list. That made sense. That was rewarded well, wasn't it? Guess what else? Intelligence is given by China and Russia, and an Iranian spy ship just sits in the Gulf and sits there and points out where and coordinates where the Houthi rebels can rocket and where they can drone strike. Senator Rick Scott joins us now, Homeland Security and Armed Services and Budget Committee. Senator, your thoughts, and what could you tell us about the Houthi rebel strike over the weekend?
Well, I talked to the White House. It's clear that there's a new sheriff in town. Attacks, threats against the United States are not going to be tolerated. Peachtree shrinks back. So I'm very appreciative that President Trump is willing to stand up and do what he said he's going to do. He's going to make the world a safer place. He's securing the border. I mean, he's doing everything he said. So whether you're the Houthis or you're Iran, you're terrorists, your days of appeasement by Obama, by Biden is over.
Also, it was interesting. He killed an ISIS fighter, the leader of ISIS, a couple of days prior to that, thanks to Iraqi intelligence. Another reason to stay in the region. That's why Afghanistan was valuable. Yes, it was an ongoing battle. Yes, it lasted 20 years, but it wasn't a hot war. But it gave us an eye, a looking glass on the terror networks as they sprung up. What I also think is interesting is that he also threatened Iran at the same time. And Iran threatened back, I will not be threatened. They're getting some off-ramps. They're choosing not to take them. Senator, I don't know how much longer we can wait on our 40-year enemy who has no missile defense until Russia could deliver a new unit. And you know Israel is anxious to do it. What could you tell our audience?
Well, first off, whether it's the United States or whether it's Israel, we cannot let Iran have a nuclear weapon. The world will be a much more dangerous place if Iran has a weapon. And so we've got to do everything we can to make sure they don't have a weapon. I think the president's going to do that. I think the president's going to do what he did before. He's going to destroy their economy through sanctions. And here's what's frustrating. We need to get our allies that believe in what we're doing, the European Union and others, to be our partners in this, whether to be our partners in NATO, to be our partners in sanctions, to actually, when they want the world to be a safer place, they're going to have to start doing their part. But Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. It's as simple as that.
So the other thing we hear, too, from the NATO general secretary I talked to on Friday, is he said, we have a bunch of your allies who want to buy your weapons, but you're not able to make them fast enough and quick enough. And this is for profit. Look at how long Taiwan is waiting for their weapon system. Look how warm Ukraine, how we had to scrounge to get them a Patriot system. Now we have nuclear submarine contract for the last 4 years that Joe Biden signed off on that we can't deliver because we can't make it fast enough. We can't build ships fast enough. Do you think we should have a Defense Production Act the same way we made ventilators during the pandemic? Can we do this in a non-war situation?
We have to. We have to be able to defend to produce weapons in this country to help our allies and whatever it takes. But let's also remember, not only are our allies struggling, okay, but we're struggling with our own military. We are not producing ships like we should. We're not producing. We don't have the weapons that we need every day for ourselves. Our defense contractors are going to have to step up. But guess what? We got to help them. If it's labor force, let's help them. If it's regulatory environment, let's help them. Whatever it is, we've got to help our defense industry step up
to make sure America has the weapons we need and our allies have the weapons they need, right? And by the way, we need to help, our European allies make sure they can help, produce weapons in their countries. So this is all hands on deck. Whether we like it or not, the government of communist China, the government of Russia, the government of Iran, the government of North Korea want to destroy our way of life. So now what can we all do as Americans? Make sure you never buy another Chinese product. If it says made in China, send it back, right? Quit helping them build up their economy so they can take money and build a military to defeat us and send more precursors here to kill our kids and our grandkids with fentanyl. So this is all hands on deck. We as Americans can do something. Our defense industry can do something. And all of our governments, we got to stop this idea that every bit of government can just slow the production of anything down through environmental stuff that might not matter, but just all sorts of things. We've got to understand we are at risk. Our way of life is at risk. Wake up.
So there was over the weekend, 261 illegal aliens were deported to El Salvador. 137 were via the Alien Enemies Act. 101 were Venezuelans via the Title 8 regular immigration proceedings. 21 were Salvadorian MS-13 gang members. 2 were special cases of MS-13, meaning they were ringleaders. A judge named James Boasberg said any plane containing those folks that is going to take off or is in the air needs to be returned. Trump ignored it, and they are now in a prison in El Salvador. I want to know where you stand, Senator Rick Scott, and also I want to know, can we get other criminals out, or is this arbitrary judge going to have power over our foreign policy?
Well, first off, I support what President Trump's doing. He's doing exactly what he says he's going to do. He's going to get these dangerous criminals and gang members out of our country and make our country safe again. I cannot believe a judge is going to side with these criminals, with these gang members. I mean, does he not care about our country? Does he not care about his kids, my kids, your kids, and the safety of this whole country? But President Trump is doing everything under his power to try to get the border secure and make this country safer. And then you have these judges like this that go off a deep end and try to stop it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
So we'll see what's going to happen, because now it's going to work its way through the court system. But this is nonstop. There's all these judicial charges and roadblocks put in front of this president as he tries to lock down our border, start releasing our energy in our country, and start cracking down on illegals in our midst. So I don't understand where the judicial branch rises up, because as soon as you find out it's a Biden judge or Obama judge, you know what the ruling's going to be.
Who's filing these lawsuits? I mean, what group thinks that it's better to have criminals and people selling drugs and terrorists in our country? If you're doing that, you just not like the people in our country? You not like your kids and your grandkids? You don't care about your family safety? We're all in this together. Okay, I don't care where you live in this country today. We have gang members. We have terrorists all around this country. We don't even know where they are. We had 78,000 people die of fentanyl overdose last year. So that happened everywhere. So if these people that are filing these lawsuits, I don't get it. You don't care about your own family, because your family can be a target just like anybody else. They're not just targeting Republicans. They're targeting Americans. So stand up for America first.
So I got to ask you, it looks like Byron Donalds is running for governor. Job you had for 8 years, and now you're senator from Florida. Do you endorse Byron Donalds?
Well, Byron's a friend. He's my congressman where I live, and so I'm going to do everything I can to be helpful to him. I think he'll be a phenomenal governor. I think he's going to win. I'm glad that Trump endorsed him.
So, what if Ron DeSantis' wife gets in?
Byron Donalds is going to win. Byron's got a track record. I worked with him when I was governor, and I've worked with him since I've been up in as a U.S. senator. He works his butt off. He believes in the right things. He'll work hard for the state of Florida. I don't think anybody's going to beat him. And plus,
Donald Trump's endorsement is golden in this state. We, in Florida, we love Donald Trump.
So lastly, on the economy, you got this economics background. Here's our Treasury Secretary on the chances for a recession and some of the confusion when it comes to tariffs. Cut 37.
I say that one week does not the market make. As Warren Buffett says, over the short term, the market is a voting machine. Over the long term, it's a weighing machine. We've got these large government deficits, 6.7% of GDP. We've never seen this. When we're not in wartime, not in recession, we are bringing those down in a responsible way. We are going to have a transition, and we are not going to have a crisis.
Your thoughts? Is he cheerleading, or is he in the is he in the numbers?
Here's what's happening. It's exactly what I did as governor. I stopped the growth, and I balanced the budget. And when I became governor of Florida, they had not balanced the budget in 20 years. And so what happened is, the government sector stopped growing and the private sector exploded. We added 1.7 million jobs. The same thing's going to happen here with lower energy prices, reducing the regulatory environment, streamlining the permitting process. What's going to happen is we're going to downsize the size of government and we're going to increase the size of the private sector. So that's exactly what we should be doing. And that's exactly what Scott Bessent's talking about. We're going to grow the private sector, stop growing the government sector. What Biden did and Obama did, they grew the government sector, and they helped part of making it very difficult for the private sector to expand.
So it's going to be interesting to see. Senator Rick Scott, thanks so much.
All right. Have a great day. See you, Brian.
All right. So we're trying to cut the size of government. We're trying to rationalize the spending, eliminate programs that are dead ends, and try to find programs, for example, that are just thrown into the system and shoveled because Joe Biden was about to leave and they have a lot of unspent money. Get this. There's a Texas nonprofit housing migrant group that house migrant kids. They took a $3 billion in grants from Joe Biden and boosted executive salaries 139%. It's called the Southwest Key Program. It pulled down those $3 billion. And according to the data compiled by the U.S. Department of HHS to help shelter and migrant kids with U.S. sponsors, as border crossings hit an all-time high. Over roughly the same period, the Austin firm, nonprofit firm, higher-ups also raked in much higher take-home pay, with the group's president disclosing a whopping 139% increase. So let me ask you something. What kind of urgency do you feel if you're that nonprofit getting billions, literally billions of dollars as 8 million cross our border, many of which are criminals, so a lot of unaccompanied minors? Do you feel as though there's a rush to quickly make sure this is stopped, make sure there's enough services there? Or are you loving the money pouring into that nonprofit? And I believe Catholic Charities falls under this. I'm not saying the executives got that pay increase, but I want Catholic Charities examined too. The House Homeland Security Committee Chair Mark Green said this: not only did the Biden-Harris administration create the worst border crisis, it empowered opportunistic nonprofits like Southwest Key to make profit out of all of it. Homeland Security Committee has continued uncovering the Biden's use of taxpayer funds to fuel its border boondoggle. That's what he's tracking down. That's what he's stopping. And you are upset with Elon Musk and are going to mess up a showroom in New York City or burn a Cybertruck in Portland? Insane. Don't move.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You guys know I voted for Cadaver Joe Biden, Smoking Joe Biden. Okay? Voted for Hillary Clinton. Okay? This is why the Democrats are in the dump. Because you celebrate people like Khalil Muhammad, Muhammad Khalil. You celebrate people like Luigi Mangione. You go out on the streets, you go f-ing crazy for the wrong people. These outlier freaks. You go nuts for the wrong people.
And that is Michael Rappaport, Democrat, on the left. We're trying to get him. He was on Fox and Friends once. We're trying to get him back on our show. and try to get him on this show. We're almost ready. Sid Rosenberg's working on him for us on Talk Radio 77 WABC. They're good friends. And when he realizes this is a show not for Republicans or Democrats, just for people who use common sense, he's got common sense, and he's extremely outraged what's happening. And a lot of people say, "What? Why did Joe Rogan no longer vote Democrat?" Because he has no choice. Why is Mike Rappaport regretting who he voted for? Listen to where they are on all these issues. Next thing you know, I expect Crockett to go on television today asking for TDA to be returned back to the United States. Incredible. Tony in Albany. Hey, Tony.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Can you hear? Well, I'll tell you, Brian, I've been hearing people talk. I follow you and all Fox News for years, and people still believe that we're dealing with rational people on the other side. You get people like Scott, who was just on, who says, "I don't know how they can do this. I don't know how they can do." Well, they do it because they're deranged. And people like Dana, who I love, is a sweetheart. But when she says, "Oh, maybe the baby eagles will bring us together," is she on some other planet?
Dana Perino?
I just don't. Yeah, yeah. I mean, she said that on her. Well, she said it on her show with Bill. But the point is, we're not dealing with normal, rational people. The people on the radical left have been doing everything inconceivable to normal common sense or human decency.
Well, Tony, isn't the American public reacting to what you're saying? They're reacting because they're not delivering Republicans. They're delivering independents. They're delivering moderate Democrats to the Republican Party. I mean, I think the Senate's going to open wide open in the midterms right now. I think the House, they've lined up 26 seats they're aiming for in the House. And one of the best things they could do is let Democrats talk. I mean it. Just listen to some of those rantings over the weekend. It's astounding. I mean, they should really rip tickets and say, "Oh, you know what? I have no idea what I think. I'm just going to watch this for a while." I appreciate it. Before we get to a call, quick announcement. This Saturday night with Fox Nation, I'm going to be in St. Louis at the Factory. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. That's the 22nd History, Liberty, and Left to go live on stage. I get a chance to talk to people like Tony in person for the VIPs afterwards. We do some questions and answer. But it's History, Liberty, and Left. It's patriotic. It's motivational, inspirational. And it's on Dayton, Ohio. We're going to be in June 21st for WHIO listeners. So hope to see everyone in person. Don't wait too long. I'm at the Victoria Theater on June 21st. Lara in Louisville. Hey, Lara.
Hi. Well, he kind of stole my thunder there, but because I was going to say the same thing, that I think we need to quit being so shocked about how what they say, because they don't have a moral compass, and they hate Trump more than they love their country. So to be, you know, "Oh my gosh, how could they be this way?" They don't care. They just want to destroy anything that has anything to do with Trump. So, and then my other question is, I've always wanted to know this. You grew up your whole life in New York, and how do you not have that New York accent?
Well, it comes out once in a while, but I do say I took courses like crazy. I had almost no money, but I would go in for speech courses, then practice while I was driving in my car just to be able to finish my words and my suffixes. But thanks so much. You made my day with that assessment. Quick note, there's a new study. You know who the number one preferred Democrat is? AOC.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here, coming to you for the final hour on this beautiful Monday. Warren Zeiders is going to be on at the bottom of the hour, a hot country music singer, former lacrosse star. He's got a series of concerts in the area, so we want to talk to him. Paul Vandenberg is standing by, too, because one of the most interesting races in this off-year election is going to be mayor of New York. Believe it or not, Governor Cuomo, as disgraced as he left office, as bad as he handled the pandemic, with all the accusers who lost their lives because of his decision with the nursing homes, is leading by about 20 points. He's a staple in Albany, capital of New York. And if anybody knows who's got momentum, and Andrew Cuomo, and can put in perspective, if he can actually pull this off, or he's going to fall apart in the end, or if he learned anything, it is Paul. So Paul's going to be with us, too. So we have a lot to go over, too. We're following everything that's happening. We see right now that the Houthi rebels, hours after we hit them and killed 39 minimum, They tried to blow up one of our ships. We easily knocked their drones out of the sky. But you got to wonder, they're not backing off. Are we ever going to be able to safely open up the Gulf of Aden or the Red Sea? So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This problem is with the base and the core of the Democratic Party. They are as far underwater with young voters as I've seen. And I work for Obama. I've not seen Democrats this far underwater. A lot of this is really around the core and these young voters.
Dems in meltdown. That was Cornell Belcher, a Democratic pollster, impossible to chronicle. All the infight on the left as they brawl it out. And guess what? The numbers say they've never been worse. Only 27% approval in this country.
Number two.
This law is only ever invoked during actual wartime, last used during World War II. The judge in the case ordered the flights to return to the U.S., even if they were midair. But a defiant White House claims federal courts do not have jurisdiction to weigh in since the planes had already left U.S. territory.
You think? Do I want some random judge deciding my foreign policy? Absolutely not. I love it. The president sends MS-13 and the Venezuelan prison gang TDA to El Salvador for prison for life, even though a domestic judge wants them to turn around and put him in court.
Number one.
This strike in Yemen is about their ability, the ability of the Houthis to strike global shipping and attack the U.S. Navy. There's no way the Houthis would have the ability to do this kind of thing unless they had support from Iran.
That is so true. Marco Rubio weighing in. Trump hits the Houthis and they drone back. And Iran gets a warning while the IDF seems poised to finish off Hamas after they already bombed Hezbollah up in the north today. So before we talk about that, I want to talk a little bit about the infighting on the Democratic side. We have Crockett, Congresswoman Crockett, going after Fetterman because he has a problem with her not realizing they had no leverage and they had no business trying to shut down the government and give the Republicans a win. Senator Schumer, I am not a fan, but he had no choice. And then when Fetterman brought up that Crockett's got to wake up and stop doing the videos that make her look so dumb, she fires back and say, there's a guy who only wears a hoodie out and about when it comes to the Senate floor. In fact, Crockett said this in an interview with Jake Tapper. He slammed Fetterman as bizarre. He says, your party, he goes, Fetterman's undignified antics and sad cavalcade of cell phones during the Trump address. That's what Fetterman said to Crockett. Crockett's response is this. She laughed and says, that sounded off about the Pennsylvania senator, the way he dressed. He's not the one who should be talking about anything. I mean, does this guy own a suit? Doesn't he seemingly own anything? Does he ever want to look mature? He says, I'm not really sure, but I don't show up in hoodies when I'm going onto the floor. So this is what's happening between them. Then Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who stopped the filibuster from getting erased last time, even though all the radicals in her party wanted it. So she's brawling with AOC and Ro Khanna. So Kyrsten Sinema comes out and called out the squad, AOC, and other Dems as hypocrites Saturday for pushing to use the filibusters to stymie the GOP-backed funding bill 3 years after their party demanded its eradication. Ro Khanna came back and said this, we wouldn't be here had we raised the wage. Look at the AMLO, who took the minimum wage from $4.65 to $15 and was followed by a talented woman in his own party, President Sheinbaum. Had we raised the wage and delivered child care, we would have had President Kamala Harris. I can't even read it. Kyrsten Sinema came back and said to Khanna, popular from the left, if you had eliminated the filibuster and voted for everything that the left wanted, the threat of a filibuster being used by the R's would have never happened because the Democrats would win every election and have a permanent majority. What a breathtakingly undemocratic take. That's Kyrsten Sinema. I want to talk to her. I think she's pretty right on top of it. And I just think, too, they are scrambling for a direction. And now they're still playing the race card. I mean, I'm looking at what guys like Don Lemon are saying. And Michael Rappaport brought up how their anti-Semitism is not even defended. They're not defending Israel. They're not defending Jews just because they get most of the vote and taking it for granted. Don Lemon on the rise of African-Americans who want to be Republicans. Cut 19.
I think there can be sincere Republicans.
But you can't be a sincere Black Republican.
I don't think that you can be a rational MAGA, be black and be a rational MAGA person. I think you can be black and be a Republican.
I think they would find that very insulting.
Well, I mean, the truth is often insulting.
Really? He's such a... Why people care so much about Don Lemon, but I'll play into it. Go ahead. How do you feel about that if you're Byron Donalds, who isn't responding directly to it, but is responding to the thought of being a Republican, maybe the next governor of Florida, and an impactful Republican in the House? Cut 28.
We don't fit the narrative that the media has been trying to sell people in our country, that the Democrat Party is the only home for black people. That's simply not true, simply not the case. As a matter of fact, black people are actually more conservative than the Democrat Party is. So when you see a Mia Love or you see a Tim Scott or you see myself and so many others come along, they have to vilify us. They have to demonize us. But we have the ability to push back because our conservatism really is just, it's not for the microphones. This is something that we've had to develop over the course of our lives.
And he went on to say he was in business for 17 years and he came from a rugged background and he is proud of what he did in business. And he's got a finance background and then he goes into Congress, becomes an immediate impact player and a great booking if you're in my business of interesting people to talk to. Even on the left, CNN obviously likes booking him and he's going to be out there as she tries to take over a prestigious spot, governor of Florida. And I know DeSantis is term limited out, but he said some really nice things about him. So what's going on? I mean, what's going on? Are you still taking these shots like Black Lives Matter is a legitimate organization? Cornell Belcher, you wouldn't know is black, says this about where the party is now and said this about what the vote was like in 2024. Cut 22.
I'm shocked at the bubbling up outrage that you see in the grassroots. I really am. This is a watershed moment, and I feel this way. This is a watershed moment, not for now, but also, I think, 2028, right? I think I've not seen this sort of divide since vote on the Iraq War, right? Mm-hmm. And it was the old school establishment versus the young and upcomers who said that was a wrong vote. I think when you look forward, this is going to be a moment where the younger sort of grassroots and sort of energized core of the base of the party goes, that is a defining moment. If you're on the wrong side of fighting and taking on Trump there, it's a problem just like being on the wrong side of the Iraq War.
But the problem is that might be an example that a pollster might digest. Fine. And you used to work for Obama. I understand it. But also listen to the facts. Young people are going for Republicans for the first time in my lifetime. Cut 21.
This problem is with the base and the core of the Democrat Party. Mm-hmm. They are as far underwater with young voters as I've seen. And I work for Obama. I've not seen Democrats this far underwater. Heck, only 49% of African Americans have a positive view of it. So a lot of this is really around the core and these young voters, and that fight that you see happening right now is really sort of encapsulating the problem for Democrats.
Listen, I'm going to take a time out, but I just want you to realize what he just said. You think he would say that if the numbers didn't reveal that? And now this is the year when people are honest. Next year they won't, because they're so worried about doing well in the midterms. If I'm Republicans, I park myself in Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Austin. And I say, I'm going to start solving problems. Not giving you money, but I'm going to start solving problems on education and opportunity. And I would just lock in that advantage, but earn it. Don't do it through marketing. Don't do it through slick ads. Go in and earn it. Especially Trump, that's got nowhere to run anymore. Not run from, but he has no office to run for. So Paul Vanderberg is going to be next. I want to get inside this very important race for mayor of New York City. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I know we can turn the city around. And I believe I can help. And that is why I announced my candidacy today for mayor of New York City. I am a lifelong New Yorker, and I love New York. And I want New York to not only survive, but for New York to thrive.
All right, but too bad you destroyed it for the years that you were governor, and Attorney General, you didn't exactly shine. And the way you brought us through the pandemic with that cocky swagger made things so much more damaging than you can possibly imagine. And then he left the governor's mansion in disgrace up from Albany. But now he's back, leading by about 20 points in the city. Few people understand New York politics better than Paul Vanderberg. the very successful radio show, radio station owner and host up at 1300 in Albany, New York. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, Brian, how you been? Everything good?
I'm good. Thanks so much for carrying the show. We're honored to be on every day.
Well, we love having you on.
But when I think the comeback of Governor Cuomo, I mean, do you really believe he's going to be Mayor Cuomo?
Yes. Oh, I who's going to stop him? Look, Brian, this a lot of this, there's a couple of things here, a couple of variables. Number one, it starts with the macro, the total chaos right now in the Democratic Party. And Cuomo's no fool. He's taking full advantage of all this chaos and, of course, the problems that Mayor Adams is having right now with this with the law and this Turkish beef. And he is going to slide in there and become mayor of New York. But, Brian, I don't see how anyone's going to stop him, do you?
Well, I mean, I guess he is the best name, and there's doesn't seem to be much of an alternative. But I would say this, does it blow you away the way he left office with all these female accusers, the way he handled the pandemic, $5 million in a book deal, while how to basically beat the pandemic in the middle of it?
Right. Right. Without question, you're 100% right about this. But he's taking full advantage of this chaos right now. Also, you know, don't forget, and you don't know where it came from, he got a lot of help from the White House on this. You know, when the White House decided, you know, I thought it was kind of a weak beef that Mayor Adams was throwing at the White House when he went after them over the illegals. And they wound up all of a sudden going after him over this Turkish thing, which from the beginning has seemed, I haven't been quite sure if it rises to the level of criminality. It seems as though it did with some of his staffers, but they took Adams right out of the picture. I mean, I saw polling last week on Adams, he's down to 20% favorability. I saw another poll last week where Cuomo was actually up amongst Republicans. I mean, this guy is making a comeback at a time when everything, the streets seem to be paid for him right now, Brian. I don't see where anybody is going to take him out.
You know him. What kind of guy? You watch Andrew Cuomo come up. You were working the station when Mario Cuomo was governor. What kind of guy is he?
He's a guy that if you talk to people around him that are down in Capitol all the time, you never got the impression he was a real trustworthy guy. You never came away with the idea that, you know, this is a guy you could put your arms around and it'll get you to the promised land. And he didn't. I mean, look at the way he left here 4 years ago. It was a disgrace. You know, you had all these women who were up against him with the sexual accusations. You actually had a charge that was brought against him, which was dropped by the Albany County District Attorney. It was a charge, I believe the actual charge was sex crime, something of that nature. But the DA in Albany County threw it out back in October of 2021. But you look now, he's got a 37% favorable rating in the Siena poll that just came out, a 51% unfavorable rating. He's in the race, and I don't see anybody that could take him. Brian, for people around the country who don't understand this, there is no Republican Party in New York that rises to the level of taking out candidates like this. And that's what also helps him. Chaos in his own party and no competition.
Well, you got Curtis Sliwa, who had the nomination last time and lost to Adams, but he's got to hope that hopefully people will realize the flawed candidate he's running against. Here's Andrew Cuomo over the weekend with Rosanna Scotto of Fox.
When you look back, you had an empty ship, you had an empty Javits Center. Why couldn't you put some of the sick seniors in those places?
The ship and the Javits Center were set up as precautions if we needed them for overflow. We never needed them for overflow. We got the situation under control before that. But look, COVID was a horrendous, once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. It focused on nursing homes, as you know, because that's where COVID preyed the most. 2 million Americans died during COVID. Every one of them was a tragedy. People died in nursing homes in New York under the worst situations imaginable.
All right, so he continues to not own up to 15,000 people dying because he chose to put him back in New York and it went against protocol at the time. He does not want to own up to this. Is he afraid about legal entanglements, or does he really believe he is error-free?
No, I think he just wants people to forget about it. He doesn't want to bring it up again at all. You know, he sent those people back into nursing homes, Brian, and they died because of it. And the folks out there that lost their loved ones are still out there trying to fight him. But he feels he can go out there now and just lie his way into this and not really tell the truth about all this. You go back, and he talks about it being under control. Under control, it never rose to the level that they told us originally it was going to be. Because I love that question from Roseanne about having all of these facilities available and nobody in them. If you go back to the origins, Brian, you'll see a story where they transported a patient from Queens all the way up here to Saratoga County. It was so insane the way they were running this this entire operation. They went out, they bought 40,000 life-saving units. They did all of these crazy things at the origin. And in the end, he left. I mean, he looked foolish at the end, the way he handled it.
But how about this, Paul? How about the fact that he did no cash bail? How about the fact that he doesn't allow fracking in upstate New York, even though an environmental study showed it would not do anything negative to the environment?
Right. No cash bail.
He closed Indian Point. We have no nuclear plant.
Brian, he's running around talking about the crime problem in New York. Him, Carl Hastie, Andrea Stewart Cousins, they were the people that gave you no cash bail. And now he's crying about the crime and the fracking. You know, I was reading over the weekend, Brian, about how some of the fracking, some of the elements of fracking are going to be shipped up to the Northeast now through New York, hopefully, with the approval of Kathy Hochul if they get it. And Trump was talking about it. You know, that's the Marcellus Shale in southern New York State. That is what Cuomo would not allow New York State to open 10 years ago. He said no. And by the way, one of the people that advised him on that was RFK.
Unbelievable. Well, I know. And guess look at the position he's in now, away from the environment, but more with health. Paul Vandenberg, continued success at 1300. Thank you so much. Brian Kilmeade Show continues. Warren Zeiders is next. Don't move.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So maybe we should call each other. Blame it on another. It's late. Girl, I wanna. Should we make another mistake? Gonna cuss. I say I'm a cuss. I change that in a heartbeat. Just to feel your body next to me.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I know you say to yourself, oh, I love that song. Well, you know who wrote it? Warren Zeiders. You know who my guest is? Warren Zeiders. And he's excited, number one, because he's here. Number two is because his album is now out. It's called Relapse, Lies, and Betrayal. And he is set to do his own. He's headlining tour after touring with Jelly Roll. Warren, you are excited. I'm not putting words in your mouth, all right?
I'm good, man. I am excited.
Right.
Very excited.
All right. So your thought about that song, first off, did you know it was a hit when you sang it?
I mean, I like to think that all my songs are hits in their own way, so selfishly. But with this song here, that was a title I had on my phone for some time, and I took
you said
it
you had in your phone.
Yeah.
What do you mean you sang it? You have it.
So I have. For me, when it comes to writing, if I'm inspired by something, if it's a broad spectrum idea or whatever, I have like a whole list of titles in my phone or things that inspire me, or if I think I have a really cool idea. And Relapse was a title on my phone for some time, and we wrote that song in like an hour and a half, and just she came together really easily.
So you do you sing it into your phone or?
Yeah. So if I have a melody that I like, I use voice notes too. And if I think of a concept or I got lyrics or the start of a song, I'll go ahead and like if I pull my voice notes up, I have so many different things to me whistling, humming something or something that catches my ear or whatever it might be. So yeah, my phone's just full of all those things.
And you count on yourself as the writer.
I do. So, I mean, I love Nashville because of it's called co-writing. So on this record, all songs on this new record, Relapse, Lies, and Betrayal, all of them but three, I'm a writer on. And Nashville's notoriously known for it's called co-writing. So I'm writing with a bunch of different writers in Nashville who are absolutely amazing and talented.
Right. And they understand that if they could write you a song.
Yep.
They're not giving away their idea. This is how they make money, too. Can you describe the business side of it?
Yeah, the business side for me is that, you know, when it comes to writing, there's such an art form to it. And, you know, not every artist is the same. You know, that's what makes art so great is that, you know, we have our own influences and in how we approach writing and what we want to say on lyrics. you know, for me, when I go into a room, I'm saying, hey, I don't write traditional country songs that talk about beer and trucks and whatnot. That's just never been my MO. I try to stay away from those things, which there's
what do you try to focus on?
You know, for me, this record, you know, it's a heavy title, Relapse, Lies, and Betrayal. You know, I'm 25 years old. So, like, I'm going through the dating scene right now, which is absolutely horrible for my generation. I'm 25, but I feel 35 at heart. I have such an old soul. So this writing process was talking a lot about, you know, women along the way over the last 2 years of what I've experienced and what I've gone through, and, you know, some good and not some not so good.
Do these, when the dates go bad or the relationship goes awry, do they realize they're going to be in a song?
I mean, you kind of have to at this. You kind of have to at this point. Right. I'm drawing inspiration from somewhere.
And when you say relapse, did you have a drug or alcohol?
No. So that's a fun thing about this record, too. When it comes to my writing process, specifically on this record, you know, you have a song like called Relapse, or a song on my record called Intoxicated or Addictions. You hear these words and they're so heavy, and you're thinking of drugs, alcohol, whatever it might be. I'm talking about women. I'm talking about these storylines of like what I'm going through. So for Relapse, that was a girl that I was seeing at some point in time. And we knew it wasn't going to work out just with how things were going. You know, I live a crazy lifestyle. Amazing woman. It ended okay. It was amicable. But I'm sure we all have these stories where you see an ex, and long story short, we couldn't say no to each other. So we kept falling back into one another, and you try to break it off. So I took the title like Relapse, how we kept relapsing together. And you hear anything of drugs and alcohol, but I just take it. I take a title, I take a concept, and flip it on its head.
Especially because you just finished up with Jelly Roll, and isn't this like his latest hit song about his 12-step program?
Yep.
The winning streak.
Yeah.
I think that's, no one walks here on a winning streak. So that's why I thought, okay, you probably got that from him, but you didn't. So you are a very fit guy. Give people a sense of your background. Athletics matters to you, right?
Yeah. Athletics mean everything to me. I think, you know, if you're wanting to get into working out and stuff like that, it's not just a physical thing for me. It's all mental. It's all a mental thing. It's callousing your mind, callousing your brain for the fact of, especially what I do for a living. It's physically taxing. It's emotionally taxing. Like, it takes a lot out of you. So for me, working out is therapeutic. That's my time to, you know, really put my time and effort in and focus on myself. You know, what's the saying? Look good, feel good, man. And
but you were a college lacrosse player.
Yep.
I mean, you played lacrosse your entire life, I guess.
Yep. So the whole road life thing, although it is hard, I was raised in that lifestyle. So I played lacrosse for 12 years. So for me, I'm no stranger to travel. So I played 365 days a year. It wasn't just like, lacrosse is a spring sport. I was playing summer league ball. So I was traveling.
Yeah.
Fall turnaround.
And there's indoor too.
Yeah. Fall. I'm playing fall tournaments outside in 30 degree weather up here in Pennsylvania, New York, all up and down the East Coast, Maryland. And then, like you said, winter league rolls around and then you're getting ready for preseason.
And doesn't it also help with your band and your team? Because you have that mindset of an athlete. So, okay, everyone matters.
Yep.
I might be the headliner, but I'm a part of a team sport.
100%.
And do you take that attitude with your crew on the road?
I do. And, you know, I try to be the best version of myself every single day. And, you know, I'm a huge firm believer in, you know, putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. Speaking of health conscious things, I'm a huge ice bath guy. You know, it doesn't get
you do that?
Yeah, it doesn't.
I can't get myself to do that.
It takes getting used to, but I'll be honest, you never get used to it. You know, getting into 39.
But they said it's the best way to burn fat.
Burn fat, and what I love about it is it's those 4 to 5 minutes. You're by yourself. You do it kind of first thing in the morning. So I do it in the mornings when I'm back home. And
you have a plunge pool you dug into the ground, or you get one of those one above ground?
I actually have one that has a system attached to it. It's almost like, and it's it keeps it filtrated and everything, and it keeps it at a nice cool temperature. So I hop in the morning, and you spend 4 or 5 minutes in there, and you're doing your breathing exercises, and it's just kind of like I even pray in there sometimes too, just to start the day off on a good foot.
Now you got a bunch of concussions.
Yeah.
That's kind of kept you from sports. Do you sometimes worry about that, short-term memory loss or things of that nature?
I always joke around about this. I say, you know, as long as I can remember my lyrics on stage, and we've been doing good so far, that I'm feeling good.
But you do have to watch yourself.
You do.
Like a small hit, because my son had the same thing. Played soccer.
Yep.
When he was young, got a concussion. And then every little incident that seemed like a non-starter, would he be out for weeks? And then he stopped playing.
Yeah. It's because, like you said, once you have one, you're so much more prone to getting more that much easier. And, you know, I had a severe one my freshman year where I blacked out, started seizing on the field. They called an ambulance. Like, it was, wow. I was out for 6 months. Like, it was rough. But, you know, I had to go through it to grow through it. And I always say that the good Lord was just kind of trying to let me know, like, I had to learn the hard way. It's like, hey, this is not for you anymore. I got bigger plans for you. And here we are 5 years down the road. And now I'm doing this for a living.
Absolutely. So you're in real good shape, as I mentioned. That came up when you were on Kelly Clarkson's show. Cut 53.
I don't think people know what lacrosse... Oh,
I might have to take the jacket off.
I didn't know that was coming. I need to be prepared for that. Well, that's nice. Are you still athletic? Is it a big thing for you? Not like that. I mean, like... What I mean by that is... I hate to say this because I hate working out, but I do genuinely feel better when I am, like, active physically. So do you still do that even though you're on the road and doing music?
100%.
Yeah.
It is the reason why I am staying sane on the road.
Yeah.
I work out every single day.
Good for your mental, emotional health.
100%. And ice baths, saunas, you name it.
Are you good with the cold?
Oh, yeah.
The cold plunge.
Oh, yeah.
It is Satan's den. Yeah.
Can I just say, it seems like you have a chemistry, you two, both like music.
Yeah, I've heard some stories that people say I should, pursue it.
But you don't want to date a famous person, do you?
Don't
you want someone anonymous? You don't want to be battling for the spotlight, do you?
You're the first person to ask me that. And, you know, I'm such a competitive person that
ruin everything.
I eat, sleep, and breathe this thing. And I think for me, honestly... Take the fame thing aside from it all and the competitive side. For what I'm looking for in a person is, like, I need that person to kind of help me turn it off. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
That way you're not going into it. And then it's like, now they're talking about their thing where it's also like, oh, this is what's going on social media for me and all this stuff. And it's just like, nah, I need that, like, safe space where they're kind of telling me, yo, let's shut it off. Let's just go.
Put out the garbage. Be like everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, yeah.
Okay. Warren Zeider's here. He's our guest. So... You feel like you're at the cusp of something big, and who's your mentor? Being that you're in Nashville, you know everybody. And then once you get the success you have, they feel comfortable talking to you and giving you advice. Who's giving you advice?
You know, it's tough to say, man. You know, I came to Nashville and like, I love Nashville, but my story's so unique because the day and age that I'm living in is so different than previous, I like to call them classes of country music. So, you look back to this category of like a Luke Bryan, a Carrie Underwood, a Jason Aldean. They're all coming to town together, right?
40s now, right?
Yeah, and they're no social media going on. So they're coming to town, they're writing, they're meeting each other. The guys and girls in my class, we're coming there with steam behind us. Like, we're coming there with social media followings. We're selling tickets. We're doing the thing. So it's like, we're not coming in.
So interesting.
It is. And it's like, we're not coming in and like hanging out being like, hey, like, we need to go do this together to kind of get some outreach. And, you know, then you kind of have like these bonds and stuff. It's like, yo, I know you from social media and I know you. It's like, what are you doing? It's like, oh, I'm going to my headlining tour to go play in front of 6,000 people.
So know what it is now? It's like, why is he so gorshy, so good? Yeah. You learn about the craft.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily need to know the marketing and promotion.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. It for me, the best way to describe it for me is I love so many writers in Nashville because take away the social media success I brought into Nashville. I was so nervous going there because I wasn't classified as a writer. Like, we all start somewhere. I wasn't a dude playing local dive bars for 10 years and perfecting my craft with writing. I'm coming to town being like, hey, I have a following, but I don't know how to write.
How big was the following?
The following at that stage of the game, when I was coming into Nashville, I probably had 600,000, 700,000 followers on TikTok. Wow. And I probably had 200 grand on Instagram in my name. So I was coming in with real eyeballs on me. So, you know, you go into these rooms and talking about working out, writing and singing is just like working out because it's a muscle. So it's perfecting that craft, the 10,000 hours thing. You know, we're always learning, we're always growing, we're always getting better. And for me, this writing process for this most recent record compared to my previous record, it was different. You know, I have more songs under my belt. I know more about myself. I'm now 25 years old. I have more experience on the road. So like...
So what year did you walk in? 20?
So I walked in, I want to say around 2021. And from that point to here, now we got two records out in the last 2 years. And Like we said, kicking off my spring tour and then kicking off the fall tour.
So instead of someone going to a talent show going, wow, that guy's good, they look at TikTok and they go, this guy's popular. So then the agents and managers are calling you.
Yeah. I mean, I came to town and my manager who's here today, he was trying to get a hold of me for 4 months, man. 4 months in my DMs. And
I was so overwhelmed.
I didn't even know. Like, I didn't even know. And there was record labels. There was publishing companies in my DMs, but I wasn't checking.
Did you have someone doing that, or did you have a knack for social media yourself?
It was all me.
So you were posting yourself?
I was posting myself, and my manager actually jokingly thought that I was already under a management company.
Because you were that good.
Because of my marketing background. And I was strategically marketing myself. I was releasing the music. I went to Guitar Center and bought, you know, a microphone. I bought an interface, and I watched a YouTube video on how to record, set up soundproofing panels in my old, I called it like the Xbox room, like growing up where you and your homies would play Xbox and stuff and hang out, and set up this little studio, makeshift studio, and recorded my entire acoustic covers album in that room as one takes, just me singing and playing guitar. No mixing, no mastering, no none of that.
Did you teach yourself?
Yeah.
You taught yourself to play guitar?
Yep.
Do you realize I took like 2 years of guitar lessons?
Mm-hmm.
I could play the notes, but I didn't have it. My dad had it. He had a bunch of bands, like the old like Benny Goodman era bands, but I just didn't have it. My brother had a knack for it, but to me, I was structure.
Yeah.
I was like, and you were just the opposite.
Yeah, for me.
You, it was a feel.
It was a feel thing for me, and you know, I didn't go to school for music. I didn't go to school for music theory and all that stuff.
Your parents?
No, I have no musical background. So I did take some guitar lessons in sixth grade. I was horrible doing the lessons because I never practiced because I was so focused on sports.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is a waste of time. So everything from that point on was self-taught. It was just playing by ear. It was figuring it out. I was watching YouTube videos and all those things. So the musical ear for me and the musical gift of my voice, I say, is God-given. I think we all have our gifts in this life. And when it comes to even this record, I'm a producer on this record, so I have no producing background. It's just all about musical sound, ears, and I just have a knack for it.
Work ethic and talent matters. So Warren Zeider's here. A couple more minutes when we get back. His album is now out. It's called Relapse, Lies, and Betrayal. 21 tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Back in a moment.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
But you rescued me from reaching for the bottom. Brought me back from being too far.
Warren Zeider's is here, and that was one of your first big hits on TikTok, right?
That was the first video I ever posted.
And to cover of Tennessee Whiskey.
Yeah, and so the story behind that was, it was during COVID. I post this video on a platform.
You're not famous yet.
No, a platform I have no idea anything about. My sister told me to download it and just start posting videos of yourself singing because she was like, you never shut up anyways. So might as well film yourself doing it. And posted it, went to bed, woke up to 30, 40,000 likes on the video. And I was like, well, this is kind of...
How many followers did you have?
I probably woke up to like 5,000-6,000 followers. I was like, this is kind of cool.
Wow. Although I don't like, I know TikTok is great. I just really feel the Chinese are spying and trying to destroy us. But we'll talk about that later. So on March 22nd, coming up this Saturday, you're going to be at the Pioneer Square at Petco. Wow, you're going to be at the San Diego Padres Stadium?
I guess so. Yeah, that sounds about right.
How great is that? Then you get up at the Pinnacle in Nashville, Tennessee. The Pinnacle, what, 5,000?
Yeah, 5,000, yeah.
What do the VIP seats get you?
I have no idea. That's a great question. That's a management question,
really?
Man.
Okay, I'm going to start taking more control of your career if you don't mind. March 29th at the Township Auditorium in Columbia, South Carolina. And then you're going to be at The Rave, the Eagles Ballroom in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And then that's on the 3rd. April 4th, you're going to pick up quickly, right?
Mm-hmm.
No dawdling. You're going to go over to Waukee, Iowa. Did I say that right? That's going to be the Vibrant Music Hall, and then April 5th at the Armory in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're going to be home much.
Yeah, I'm going to be all over the place. I promise you, all jokes aside, I do have a very good handle on the pulse when it comes to my career. Fun fact, actually, both my mom and dad work for me, which is really cool.
Oh, really?
Yep.
What's their background?
So my mom and dad both come from the business world. My dad did life insurance investments for years growing up. when I was a baby. And then my dad ran a car dealership for about 15 years. My mom was a CFO.
How great is that?
Oh, it's great, man. My dad looks over my, you know, real estate portfolio. He handles my merch. So every time a fan gets anything from my online store, it's touched by his eyes.
I have an idea. Have him just chaperone you on your relationships to help you with your music. By the way, the few good lines there was a good exchange at the counter. We could do that. That's just my advice. Warren Zadish, congratulations on everything.
Appreciate you.
Do you mind if you sing us out?
You want me to start singing?
Well, actually, you are playing right now.
Oh, sound good. There
Where do we
go.
Get your music?
You guys can find my music anywhere you listen. You got Amazon, Apple Music, Sirius XM.
Sounds
good. I'm all over the place, baby.
All right. And he is the writer. Good job, Warren. Congratulations on everything.
Fox News Audio presents the Fox Nation Investigates podcast, Evil Next Door, exploring the life and crimes of five serial predators from across the United States.
It's a very disturbing case.
In never-before-heard interviews and first-hand perspectives.
It's described as pure evil. That's a good description.
The Fox Nation Investigates podcast, Evil Next Door. Listen and follow now with Amazon Music. Must listen to podcasts from Fox News Audio. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.